Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, friends. It's me, Sharon McMahon, host of Here's Where It Gets Interesting, a podcast that tells the stories of America you probably haven't heard. Our goal is to ignite your curiosity about the fascinating people and events left out of the textbooks. I'm often joined by guests who share with us their insights about history, culture, and politics, so tune in and get ready to learn about some of the most brain-tingling moments in American history. You can listen to Here's Where It Gets Interesting wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another day, indeed a new week at the Damage Report. And I personally am hoping for another fantastic Monday, but I can't make that alone. There's another half to that recipe, and she joins us now. How's it going?
Hey, buongiorno, come vai?
I want to thank you for taking time out from your vacation that you're on right now to join us. It's very nice of you.
You're welcome. I have put a background of the Amalfi Coast for people listening. It's gorgeous. I was supposed to be on a vacation right now, and now it's being punted for 2021. Clearly, I'm the real victim. I just want everyone to know that out there.
Clearly. You know, I was supposed to have a honeymoon at some point. It's looking like that might take a while. Maybe we'll schedule it for the 10th anniversary or something. But anyway, thank you for joining
us. Your job really is to make sure you stay married until the quarantine is over.
And you know what? It's a full-time job. So anyway, thank you for joining us. Glad that you're here. And those of you out in the audience, as well. I saw one person, by the way, who quickly noted that they gave up on notifications for the stream because the notifications seem to sometimes come 3 to 4 minutes late. And I would like to reassure you that the fact that you got the notification at 10:03 is not the notification's fault. The show just started late again because I continue to have sound and internet problems. So continue to get the notifications. They are reliable, even if I am not.
And like, calm down if you can't wait 2 minutes, okay?
Thank you. No, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Glad to have you all here. There's already a bunch of you here. I mean, there's 1,100 people. There should be, right? If I were to check right now, there'd be 1,100 likes, right? You're all doing your part and pitching in. No, but anyway, please do that. And later on, perhaps you'll see an appearance of a dog if we hit 1,000. No big deal. Ooh. Might be a little bit fun. Okay, so there's a lot that we're going to be talking about in today's episode of the show. We're going to be doing a little bit of catch-up on all that transpired over the weekend. Just a bit of it, because the whole show could be the nonsense that was our government, the way that it spent its weekend as thousands more Americans died. But we are going to have that. In addition, we're going to have details on the national rent strike that is set to go active in just a couple of days. We've got new details in the allegations from Tara Reid. We had a story ready to go on this, and then just as we're about to go live, a new detail emerges in that story. So we're going to be doing a little bit of breaking news as well in there. And Tom Cotton, who does he think should be suffering the consequences in response to coronavirus? We've got that for you, too. It's going to be fun. Fun. So, Francesca, thank you again. You ready to jump into this?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Oh, and by the way, everybody who's here, feel free to continue to send in super chats and send in tweets at hashtag TDR live. We will be reading some of those soon. But with that, let's start with the news. We went into the weekend in the aftermath of the Tide Pod Challenge presidency that we've got. And the ever-evolving explanation as to why the president spent one of his official coronavirus press conferences sort of just asking questions, people, about putting light in people's bodies and injecting disinfectants into our lungs because it does a hell of a job on the virus. And by Friday, they had settled on he was just being sarcastic. And why are you all getting so triggered? And he wasn't even talking to Dr. Birx. No, he was talking to the reporters, even though he was looking at Dr. Birx and very clearly talking to her. Well, look, the response to all of that was so bad that Donald Trump appears now to just be done with the press conferences, with him tweeting, "What is the purpose of having White House news conferences when the lamestream media asks nothing but hostile questions and then refuses to report the truth or facts accurately? They get record ratings, and the American people get nothing but fake news. Not worth the time and effort." I will remind you, of course, that the thing that we're talking about right now was not the result of a harsh question, or indeed a question. He was just vamping in the way that he does, and he suggested insane things. And so, apparently, Francesca, he might not want to do any more of these, especially when really fast. So we were sort of going to do this story, and we were going to speculate that they might be done, that he was implying it. But according to the New York Times, no, today's press conference is canceled.
Yes!
And they didn't do one over the weekend, which they normally have done.
So you're saying Donald Trump canceled himself?
Apparently he has been canceled.
Cancel culture has really gone too far.
Cancel culture is the invisible enemy.
It's the invisible enemy. It came for me. Mm-hmm. The pandemic tried to cancel me, and then I canceled myself before I could do that.
A preemptive cancellation.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, we don't know for sure, but what do you think about the sort of the story after the story, the reaction to the bleach stuff?
The story after the story that he's not going to hold press conferences, I think, is very good. I mean, look, the reality is he's spreading more disinformation than he is spreading facts. So we should not be listening to him. He should not be going in front of the nation because people are putting disinfectant up their bums. That's just what's happening. And there have been multiple reports of that in various ERs, and that is the last thing I, as an overworked nurse, would ever want to have to deal with. So I think this is obviously a win until we can get real, you know, actual real results. It's like, yeah, stop grandstanding and start working. We know he's not actually going to get to work, but hopefully the people around him are. And I think it is an opportunity for people like poor Deborah Birx, to be honest with you, to have some like alone time to be able to try and talk some sense into Trump versus having to do that, or Dr. Fauci having to do that sort of on a national stage.
Yeah. Yeah. And Dr. Birx, I mean, you probably saw over the weekend, she was talking with Jake Tapper, and she was asked about the medical advice, the questions that Trump had asked. And the thing that she was annoyed about was that it was still in the news. Well, look, I get it. If I were her, I wouldn't want it to be the news either. But one great way to keep it out of the news would have been for him to keep his mouth shut for once and just let the doctor speak. If the press conferences overall are done, I think that's a good thing. I mean, people have literally died because of the horrible information that Trump has spread. Individuals that we can point to and say, their family members say they died because of the advice they got from Donald Trump. And the issue, too, is that you could have something like this that does not need to have the inclusion of Donald Trump. So in terms of the future of this, I want to go very briefly to this is the Washington Post did an analysis of 2 weeks of these press conferences. So we got some from that, some from overall the time. The president has spoken so far for 28 hours at the 35 briefings that we've had in a little bit over a month. 60% of the total time that anyone spoke, even though he knew far less than anyone else who was speaking, including all of the reporters and aides. Over the past 3 weeks, the tally comes to more than 13 hours of him speaking, including 2 hours spent on attacking the press, 45 minutes praising himself and his administration. Let's pause on that for a second. Imagine if I just started saying, I'm doing a great job, me and Francesca are doing a great job, what a great show with the job that we're doing, and I kept doing that for 45 straight minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you got, okay? Out of all of that, there were 4.5 minutes spent expressing condolences for coronavirus victims, sort of acknowledging that now more than 55,000 Americans have died. So he spent 20 times as much time attacking the press, 10 times as much time praising himself, as acknowledging the ever-increasing and horrific death toll that we've had so far. So if those were to be shut down, look, I know we're supposed to be really scared about that, right? Because we're the lamestream media and we just want the free ratings and all that. But no, I'm happy. Bye. Bye, press conferences. Be done with you.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I haven't watched nearly as much as you have, John, of these press conferences, but you can only assume, right? And I think a lot of people, you know, who don't subject themselves to the press conferences, they assume there's horrible things being said, but then they're also like, well, maybe he's, you know, giving a moment to talk about victims, or he is expressing condolences for the frontline workers. Maybe there is that moment. I can only assume because that's the presidential thing to do. Any you know, speech writer with half a brain or whatever, Stephen Miller's size brain, you know, would do something like that, would write that into whatever he's going to say. And the reality is, that's not the case. He is not expressing any kind of sympathy. He is not talking about frontline workers. And there you have the mathematical proof that this is all just about him, once again, making literally everything, including a pandemic, about him.
And stupidly, too, because... obviously, he's going, everything that he thinks of, everything that he does is designed to sort of help himself. But for all of the credit that we're supposed to give him for being this amazing, like, political tactician or whatever, think about how easy it would be for him to run these press conferences a way that actually benefits himself, to not rant against the media and stuff like that. Just show up, say a few things that show that you understand the gravity of the situation, you have empathy, you're going to protect people, and then parade out doctors and state officials to say, here's how many masks we just shipped to Michigan, here's the thing, we did this, we did this, we did this. Do that for 20 minutes, totally serious, show that you're taking it seriously. That's going to placate the people who probably aren't going to support you, but it's definitely going to be loved by the people who do. Why not just do that?
I mean, look at Cuomo. I mean, Cuomo has written this thing. Like, I think it is good, obviously, to speak to the state of New York, but let's be real. Cuomo is milking this for everything that it is worth to show what an actual leader does look like, you know, for better or worse, even if he's, you know, trying to cut Medicare, et cetera. But this is the thing about the quote-unquote lamestream media, which, okay, 13-year-old term, and no one should use that term ever. Please don't. It is beneath you. But the fact is, you're absolutely right that from the beginning of this administration, we all knew that all he had to do was just a hat tip of presidentialness, just a little bit of, you know, good behavior, and the media would be eating out of his hands. Wow, how presidential.
100%.
And in fact, there were moments where, you know, when he did try to do that, like rolling out veterans in his, you know, State of the Union address, he got called presidential, right, by Van Jones. That was a very big moment, you know, and people jumped on him for that, but whatever. But it's true that, like, I'm not just trying to talk about Van, but many pundits are just waiting for him to say or do something presidential, and they will give him all of the props and all of the glory. Yeah. And he's too stupid to know how to play a very, very simple system.
No one has ever been as right as you are being right now. How, and the thing, look, so he's an idiot and he's surrounded by people who are awful, but generally they're not going to be an idiot to the level that he is, because that's virtually impossible. They could be horrible racists like Stephen Miller and stuff like that. But how do they not get that him spending an hour a day, like, inspecting shipments of ventilators, you know, for photo ops, wouldn't be better for him? I'm talking about just purely pragmatically for him.
Like Kim Jong-un would do that, RIP.
Yeah.
You know, but like,
it would be so much smarter. Alternatively, one other way he could go that I think would be good for him as well would be to actually take it seriously and actually help people. That would be great. Spend other people's money to save people's lives, you stupid, stupid idiot. That's what I would do.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Over the weekend, there was controversy over whether Donald Trump is taking it all seriously. Not specifically just the coronavirus, but the fact that he is president. Is he actually engaged in his job? Is he working? And he lost it when a New York Times report implied that perhaps he is not. So I want to read you just a few excerpts from it, and then we'll give you his reaction. The report said, "President Trump arrives in the Oval Office these days as late as noon, when he is usually in a sour mood after his morning marathon of television. He's been up in the White House master bedroom as early as 5 a.m. watching Fox News, then CNN, with a dollop of MSNBC thrown in for rage viewing." Although it seems like the CNN stuff would probably also be rage viewing. "He's angry even with Fox, an old security blanket, for not portraying him as he would like to be seen. And he makes time to watch Governor Andrew Cuomo's briefings from New York, closely monitoring for a sporadic compliment or snipe." So look, I get that if Cuomo praises him, he's going to want to see that. That's good. Wanting to be praised when you're an incredibly vain person, I understand. But think about spending your morning so focused on the news. But even if you're going to be focused on the news, to be focused on the news specifically to try to see who's being mean to you, to see who's insulting you. And the thing is, like, it's not like I don't sort of understand the inclination. I'm in a much worse mood when I go live on the Damage Report if I've spent a lot of time on Twitter that morning, but I'm an idiot and it ain't 7 hours. Some pretty significant differences. I'm also not president, by the way. That's three important differences right there. But he is waking up, Francesca, spending, let's say, 3 to 7 hours watching cable news, getting into his little, like, you know, impotent rage mode. And then doing the press conference. And importantly, a lot of sources are saying that he no longer takes part in the briefings before the press conference. It's one of the reasons why he's saying crazy things when he finally gets there. But this is apparently the mode he's in. He's spending his days, once again, eating food in bed, watching cable news for literally hours, morning, noon, and night. And by the way, during the worst pandemic that has hit the United States in some time.
I mean, like, the presidency was such a moment for him to just, like, you know, come into his own and, like, live his, just like, be his best self, you know what I mean? Just, like, put up a photo of Barack Obama and be like, oh my God, what if, you know? And he's failed at every single moment. Like, if I were his therapist, I would be like, sir, you're the president, once again. So I just feel like he's just not living his best life. And if only he could, then maybe Americans could literally just live in general, you know? But I also am like, I don't ever want to imagine Donald Trump in the morning outside of his, like, slithering into that suit and, like, putting on his little, like, heels that he does. So he, like, tilts forward and he looks less disgustingly huge as he is. Like, just imagine, like, a crumpled little, like, sheet in between Trump's, like, pasty pink legs as he's watching.
No, stop. No more. Okay. Look, the reason that this matters is because supposedly, if you listen to the people who are closest to him, his focus is on how his performance on the virus is measured in the news media and the extent to which history will blame him. And the thing is, that is baked in. We're not going to be able to change that. But what I keep trying to say, we were just talking about it, is, and he's never going to watch this, I understand that, but he could actually do the right thing. And that would be good for obvious reasons. It would save lives. But also, it would protect his reputation. It would stop history from blaming him more. If you didn't do the bad thing, history wouldn't be able to blame you. You wouldn't be getting bad reviews if you were doing a good job. And I wish that we could, like, turn that vain obsession that he has with himself in a positive direction that could be used to cause him to just be driven all day to make sure that we're nailing this thing, that we're doing all that we can. And maybe it's not too late to go in that direction. We've hit 55,000 deaths. Let's not hit 100,000. How about that? How about let's get him to take it seriously? And maybe if he spends a little bit less time chasing cameras and a little bit more time talking to his experts and following their advice, he can succeed both substantively and in terms of the optics.
This is, obviously you're right, John. John for president. This is the best part about Trumpism and just MAGA ghouls. The idea that they think that Trump is like their alpha male and he's so strong and everyone else is like a beta cuck. Like, fool, you're talking about the most insecure, not just president, but probably person that any of us have ever encountered in our lives. Like, his insecurity is plastered everywhere. Every day he stands behind a podium and just says how small his hands are, how tiny the thing in his pants are, and how insecure he is about it all the time. Like, that's all he does.
It comes through.
He is the ultimate beta cuck. Like, Trump is the least alpha ever. Like, I don't want to, like, traffic in those terms. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to, he's super insecure, and it's very, very clear.
Yeah. I've been sort of threatening to write a book laying out how fake conservative masculinity is for a long time.
Yeah.
Let's write it together. Come on.
Oh my God. I'd love
right to. Wingers or beta cucks. That's a title that'll move copies. Come on.
I mean, you've got to couch it in some kind of pickup artistry though, John.
I would end up doing that even if I tried not to. So look, I want to give him a chance to respond. He says, I work from early in the morning until late at night, haven't left the White House in many months except to launch Hospital Ship Comfort in order to take care of trade deals, military rebuilding, and then I read a phony story in the failing New York Times, always failing, it's taking years to fail though, about my work, schedule, and eating habits, written by a third-rate reporter who knows nothing about me. I will often be in the Oval Office late into the night and read and see that I am angrily eating a hamburger and Diet Coke in my bedroom. People with me are always stunned, anything to demean. Imagine if Obama had tweeted about the allegation that he was eating a hamburger. By the way, that's the second version of the tweet. The first had to be replaced because he once again spelled hamburger wrong. And it's not the reporter that's saying it. It's the source. It's like, check the people around you if you don't want them to know that. And it's also filled with lies. Like, I haven't left the White House in many months. Yeah, except for the many golfing trips and the many rallies you did, literally in public. They were televised. The trip to India you took just a couple of months ago.
Yep.
The many trips to Mar-a-Lago where you ran events that were very public. All of these things, just constant lies. And he's lashing out because he's mad. Some people, when they're criticized in this way, will then overcompensate to try to ward off future criticism. Please go in that direction. Actually work. Or, like, either work hard or get out of the way. And just put Fauci in charge of it and give him actual power. Make him a czar or whatever. Like, replace Mike Pence, who doesn't know what he's talking about, with someone who actually seems to care about saving American lives.
I mean, absolutely. And yet we've seen time and time again that anyone who tries to steal the disgusting spotlight that spews down on Donald Trump, they get axed. Like, you can't steal his spotlight. He never wanted this. And yet if someone else tries to commandeer it, he will absolutely fire that person.
That's sort of my fear. You know, this might seem weird, but I don't know if you saw over the weekend, but Brad Pitt played Dr. Fauci in like a sketch on SNL or whatever. And when I saw that, I thought, I get that, like, it's funny because Fauci said he wants Brad Pitt to play him, and Brad Pitt seems to like Fauci, and so he wants to play him and give him compliments or whatever. But, like, is there any individual thing that could be done that raises the odds that Fauci gets fired than Brad Pitt playing him on TV and Trump hearing about it? That seems like the sort of thing that would result in the serious doctor getting fired, which would certainly be unfortunate.
But I would love to see that. Like, if Bruce Willis comes on, I mean, I feel like he's a little bit of a right winger too. And just,
I believe so. I'm not sure.
Just to play Trump, to be like, you're a tough guy too,
Maybe balance it out. Uh-huh. By the way, there was another response from the White House. White House officials say Trump works so hard he often misses lunch.
Yeah.
So in the couple of hours after that story went live with that quote, he started binge retweeting. He retweeted 30 different accounts, including things like a deep fake of Joe Biden. He retweeted a conspiracy theorist who was saying that the death count was being artificially elevated. So he's working like clicking the retweet button, like that's, you know, if you're old and you have old joints, that's kind of work, but that's what he's doing. And he is, by the way, so we predicted this weeks ago. No, he's now joined the death count is fake. You shouldn't actually pay attention to it.
It's not funny. I wish it were funny. I am trying to make light of it, but I don't want it to be funny anymore. I am a stand-up comic. Mm-hmm. I talk about Trump on stage, or I used to before we were all, consigned to our homes.
Yeah.
And now I'm a famous Zoom comic. open for Fred Armisen.
That is awesome, by the way.
Okay, I didn't really. I just went up before him. The point is this, I don't want Trump. Nobody wants to make fun of this guy anymore. He's a walking satire. You can't make this stuff up at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm ready for it to not be. You know what I want? I want politics to be funny by Francesca being funny and Ida being funny and Alonzo being funny. And I'm good with that. Don't need Trump. Don't need the president to be funny. Let's have serious, responsible people in positions of power and then comics that mock them. That's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like that. We're not supposed to be mocked by the president. He's not supposed to steal our joke. He's like the guy reading out your punchline in like yelling it out in the club before you even get there.
So we know that already, with one rent check day having passed during this pandemic, the paltry stimulus that some people got and many still are waiting to get was not going to save people who have to pay rent. Sometimes in a lot of parts of the country, rent is higher than that stimulus check anyway. Well, we're rapidly approaching another rent day, but this time some activists are getting prepared for it with a national rent strike. So let's talk about some of the details. At least 400 families who live in buildings, each containing over 1,500 rent units, are coordinating building-wide rent strikes, according to Sia Weaver, campaign coordinator for Housing Justice for All. This is focused in New York City and Harlem and the Bronx. We have additionally, though, over 5,000 people have committed through an online pledge to refuse to pay rent in May. And the thing is, these are individuals who are saying they are not going to pay rent. There are obviously a lot of people who are going to participating due to their complete and utter inability to pay rent because so many millions of people have lost their jobs and the assistance that they've gotten from the government is wholly inadequate to make it so that they can't afford. So this is pretty new. We haven't seen something this big, this wide scale in some time.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what is happening in New York City, whether there's been a moratorium on evictions. But I'm super happy that there are actions like this happening because, listen, I think a lot of times in this country, we have to unlearn the fact that if we are left without a job due to a pandemic that our government didn't pay for, that somehow that's still our fault. Mm-hmm. I think in our really rugged individualistic ideology that we have, which of course is only applies to working people and not the like giant corporations, we're like, well, if it's your fault. Listen, if you can't pay rent, it's your fault. It's even if in the situation, I think these activists are saying, absolutely not. It is not our fault. And look, my landlord or my building property manager, whoever, take it up with the government. Take it up with the state government. Take it up with the federal government. It is not my fault. I cannot go to work and I don't have a job. And I wish that people like the protesters, you know, who were defying stay-at-home orders would actually get on board with that because that is real. Look, if you can't go to work and you can't make money, I get it. Mm-hmm. Now it's don't add the 5G and white nationalism and Bill Gates crap on top of it. And maybe we can actually build something.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I have to wonder, like it's been what, 4 weeks now since we've heard like any sort of like passion behind a drive for further stimulus? Like it was before the first of the month. What do they think is going to happen?
Yep.
Like, okay, maybe you have X people, X families who are signing up saying they're not going to pay their rent. Do they think that the money is just going to miraculously appear from somewhere? That do they think that, you know, like the polls that you've probably seen for years of the like 40% of Americans who can't deal with a $450 economic emergency, do they think that a multi-$1,000 recurring emergency is somehow going to be easier to get past when combined with the fact that literally millions and millions of people are losing their jobs every single week? And those are the ones who are lucky enough to actually get through to unemployment and be registered. God only knows how high the numbers are. Like, the people in Washington seem to really be operating under the assumption that this is all fake, that this isn't real, because they're not doing anything about it. And right. So we're obviously concerned about the individuals, those who've lost their jobs, those who can't pay rent, those who can't pay their bills, who can't get food for their family, all of that stuff. But let's talk about the people that they actually care about. The landlords are not going to get paid, okay? The landlords thus might not be able to pay the mortgages on their buildings. Mm-hmm. People who can't pay their mortgages are going to get foreclosed upon. I understand that for some rich people that's amazing. That works out so well for them. But that is going to be another economic disaster. Like, we're in the middle of one right now.
Yes.
Largely due to people losing their jobs and unemployment. But we're about to have a housing crash on top of it. All of this is looming. And I don't see almost anyone in D.C., except for a couple people that we're going to mention in just a bit, who seem to be taking it seriously.
Yes. And I think it's our job, hopefully, when we do get out of our homes, or when we, you know, protest from a safe social distance, to make sure that the fallout from this doesn't fall on the same people once again. Because, you know, I'm thinking about the 2008 bailout and the ways in which a problem that was created from the financial sector on these subprime mortgage loans and all that, which, you know, obviously many, many, many people had to leave their homes, they were foreclosed upon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All that led to just a further consolidation of big banks. Mm-hmm. So the question is now is, what is all this going to lead to? Is it going to lead to a consolidation, a further consolidation of the restaurant industry, or the, you know, the manufacturing industry, or service sector, whatever it is, or retail industry, right? As if it weren't already crazy consolidated.
Yeah.
Or are the people going to demand something different?
I mean, I know one thing that could have influenced the direction that we go in, and it would be having a different candidate right now. That consolidation seems like it's coming. I mean, you pointed out the restaurants. That seems like that's going to be huge. I mean, we're effectively living out Demolition Man right now, because Taco Bell might be the only one that survives this by the end of it. All restaurants are going to be Taco Bell. And honestly, the feeling that I'm getting, have you seen Brewster's Billions? Have you seen that movie?
No,
so it's this guy is going to inherit billions of dollars, but before he can do that, he has to spend, I don't know, $50 million without donating. He has to spend it in a very limited amount of time. So it's about excess and stuff like that to achieve a weird end, which is running out of money, effectively. Well, what they're doing right here is, like, let's see how much money we can throw at rich people specifically to create a revolution, an uprising across America. Yeah. Because at some point, people need to eat. At some point, people are going to be thrown out of their homes. The only thing that's forestalling some of this is the fact that some states and cities have done eviction stops on evictions that we talked about. If not for that, how many people would be newly homeless in the past month? I don't even know. It's scary to even think about. Now, I do want to mention a couple of the people who are talking about this. You have, from the beginning, representatives like AOC. She said today, I think it was, I want everyone to know that the White House, Mnuchin, McConnell, and Congress know that there is a housing crisis looming due to inaction on rent and mortgage relief. If we don't act ASAP, millions could face foreclosure and eviction. Dems have plans to stop it. It's being blocked. Representative Ilhan Omar tweeted, rent is due on May 1st. The American people need help now. And she has a bill designed to do that.
Nice.
But while the situation we have right now is infuriating, I want to add one little extra set of facts on top of it that is just about the most infuriating thing that I've seen, because we have been in this together for a couple of months now of just an absolute disaster. For many people, they've seen what little savings they had evaporate, their future plans evaporate, businesses lost, all of that. During that same time, U.S. billionaires have increased their wealth by $280 billion.
Stop.
Not since the beginning of the year, since March. Jeff Bezos, between January 1st and April 15th, his fortune has increased by $25 billion during a massive economic recession. During the stock market diving off a cliff, I've been led to believe, he is worth far more. And many billionaires have added at least $1 billion to their wealth, including Elon Musk, who I'm pretty sure has done nothing but tweet during all this. So I don't know how he's getting billions of dollars. But some people are doing very, very well.
Well, those billionaires are buying Teslas. It makes sense.
Maybe.
You know, it is alarming when outlets like the New York Times are saying the stimulus budget, the new stimulus budget, this $3.5 stimulus budget does not go far enough, right? Like you can sort of take your cues when you're reading those outlets and they're saying that there is not enough money for hospitals. There's not even enough money for comprehensive testing. And there sure isn't enough money to actually help people survive this. And AOC being the only House member to vote against the stimulus budget tells you a lot, right? About who is trying to.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
To who's actually trying to strong arm the Republicans? Because listen, I don't envy Democrats, and I'm not saying that Democrats, I don't think that they could get anything that they want passed. Because again, they're bargaining with people who do not believe in government, who believe that you're on your own, you're on the street, great. You didn't have a plan for a pandemic? Don't look to the government to help you. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to wean yourself off that, pull yourself up by the, you don't have any bootstraps? Yeah. You don't have boots? Cool. Like that's who they're negotiating with. But it is striking when you know that the numbers, for example, not just for billionaires, but for millionaires, or the majority of Congress people are millionaires.
Yeah.
How? Why? You know, insider trading, been in power for too long. But it is going to get a lot worse, and we have ourselves to rely on, and that sounds really scary, but I do think refocusing on local elections, local races, and just like, you know, mutual aid and community support and organizations that are doing real work, like there are people out there. I don't want folks to despair, because looking at the federal level, there's a lot to despair over.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the reasons we want to talk about this, is that there are activist organizations that are helping to put this together because they care about the people who are being hurt. And at the same time, yeah, I'm glad that you point out how many of them are millionaires. How many representatives right now are worried about paying their rent in 4 days? Zero? I'm assuming zero. I'm going to put out zero as the answer to that. There have been new details breaking every couple of days in the allegations against Joe Biden that have been made by Tara Reid, and we want to catch you up on a few of those. So first of all, in an interview with The Intercept, Tara Reid mentioned that her mother had made a phone call to Larry King Live on CNN, during which she made reference to her daughter's experience on Capitol Hill. Reid told The Intercept that her mother called in asking for advice after Reid, who was then in her 20s, left Biden's office. On August 11, 1993, King aired a program entitled Washington, the Cruelest City on Earth, and indeed did have a call that, according to residence records, appears to have potentially come from Reid's mother. And we actually, thanks to some great work of an individual online, they were able to track down video of that. And so here is the call.
San Luis Obispo, California. Hello.
Yes, hello. I'm wondering what a staffer would do besides go to the press in Washington. My daughter has just left there. After working for a prominent senator, and could not get through with her problems at all. And the only thing she could have done was go to the press, and she chose not to do it out of respect for him.
Or she had a story to tell, but out of respect for the person she worked for, she didn't tell it.
That's true.
Now, but these are the people who do come to the Los Romanos, right? The staff worker who says, I want to let you know about what's going
this
on, either
going
with mine
on
or also the guy down the hall.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people have a sense of obligation. They feel that this public official should be accountable if it's something.
They're whistleblowers to the press.
Okay, so unfortunately, at that point, the panel moves on to other material, and there doesn't appear to be any more with the woman that's being alleged to be Tara Reid's mother. But this does provide even more corroborating evidence at the time. It appears that her mother was aware of it, or else something suspiciously similar happening from a person who lives in the same area at the same time.
Yeah. This whole story is pretty upsetting for a lot of different reasons. But I will say that there is so much evidence to support Tara Reid's account. There are many people who she told about it, and then and now we have like actual proof of that a person she told, her mother, now relating it to Larry King. I mean, and again, this is just also goes to show how long I think staffers in Washington have had to deal with unaccountable senators and congresspeople when they do face sexual assault or harassment. Mm-hmm. I mean, so number one, I think Tara Reid's very credible. And I think number two for me, and this is the hardest pill to swallow, is that I don't know if it will make a difference in this election. I'm separating what I personally feel and also what I think the political reality is. Mm-hmm. What I personally feel is I think Joe Biden should absolutely address Tara Reid's allegations. Either I don't remember or yes, and I thought it was consensual, whatever it is, or I don't know, it happened. I'd make a whole, I don't know, breakthrough on Me Too and have a whole cry. I'm not sure what it is, but the political reality is that his opponent is Donald Trump. His opponent is the Republican Party. The Republican Party, which doesn't give a rat's behind about the Me Too movement. They think that if you address sexual assault allegations, it means you're weak, it means you did it, and ha 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 ha. Their strategy is to not talk about it and not address it at all and deny and deny and deny. And that's why you have a man who's been accused dozens and dozens of times of assault in the White House right now.
Yeah. Yeah. They're going to have to come out and talk about it. They seem to think, well, let's just wait. Like, I'm sure Trump is going to be very understanding, and it's a sensitive issue, so he's not going to bring it up. He's not going to bring it up live on the debate stage, standing 10 feet away from Joe Biden. Is that what that's what they really seem to think? That they can just, well, you know, we got through the primary. We were able to just quickly, you know, move past that. The media didn't talk about it until the primary was over, effectively. And then they suddenly started pretending that they care about it. I don't know how they can think that that's a strategy that will succeed. And to the extent that they have responded to it so far, it's to say that the entire thing is false, which right. is looking like a really bad strategy to have taken. Not to say that her story has changed or there might have been sexual harassment, but not sexual assault. To say that the entire thing is false now, as you get more and more corroborating evidence, makes it hard to believe that your account is true. The call was there. We now have, as of this morning in Business Insider, I'm seeing that a former colleague of Reed's told Insider that Reed talked in the mid-1990s about being sexually harassed by her former boss in Washington, D.C. You have a former neighbor, Linda Lacasse, who also says that she told about the assault in 1995 and 1996. Now, some of these are saying that she had talked about harassment, which is what her complaint that she says she fired was about. Some are saying that it was about assault. But when the Biden's team's story is nothing happened, there was nothing. There was no harassment, right. There was no assault, there was no complaint filed. Well, that's very easy to start to fall apart.
The problem is, John, though, I disagree that it's a bad strategy because I think it works for Republicans. Yeah. And that's who Joe Biden is going up against, is the Republican Party. Now, if this were still the primary, if Bernie Sanders were still in the race, or if this were months ago, I think we'd be having a very different conversation. Because I think that I like to think that the left, and we have seen the way that the left and the way that Democrats respond to allegations within their own party, right, in terms of Al Franken resigning over incidents that were arguably far less damning and terrible than this. So unfortunately, we live in a political world where women, and specifically sexual assault against women, is a political tool to be used against either side. Yeah. And either to silence them, either to prop them up like Trump did, wheeling out Clinton, people who accused former President Clinton of assault. You remember right before the election in 2016, women are pawns, and that is not okay. We have to stand with survivors no matter what. And yet, I will say, again, that's what I feel, but I will say that the political reality is that actually I think his strategy might work because look at the way that the right's denialism has gotten them as far as they got.
Yeah, so I guess the thing I want to ask is, Do you mean that it will be effective in sort of delaying on the topic to make sure that he wraps up the nomination? Or do you mean that you don't think that even if Trump brings it up, even if the media, you know, will do what they did with Hillary Clinton, which is during the primary pretend that none of these issues exist, but then they want to appear to be serious during the general election, so they suddenly start talking about them and it hurts her. Do you think that this in the end won't hurt Joe Biden?
I'm saying that for sure. For sure, it'll hurt him. It has already hurt him in the eyes, I think, of a lot of progressives. And I think in the eyes of a lot of actual feminists and actual people who believe in, you know, that sexual assault is bad and wrong. But yeah, I'm not even really talking about the nomination. I think that for those folks who think that somehow this is going to snowball and, you know, he won't get the nomination, I'm sorry. I think that is a little bit of a fantasy, unfortunately. And I'm not actually sure that we can afford to even entertain that line of thinking. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, look, they're sticking with it. I don't know. I mean, the fact that these two stories have both come out inside of just a couple of days, we'll see. Is CNN going to take it more seriously? Is MSNBC? Perhaps if they do, then the Biden campaign might actually do something about it. But I'm not ready to say that I don't think it'll hurt him significantly in the general election with, you know, the sort of independent voters or whatever that his strategy seems to be designed to try to bring on. But I do think it is designed to try to get him past the convention, virtual or whatever, and create a sense of inevitability. That seems like what the strategy has been from the beginning.
There already is a sense of inevitability to the primary. But if you're talking about the general, I mean, he can absolutely continue to deny and ignore. And look, if he's trying to pander and cater to Republicans who voted for a guy who said he grabs women by their genitals, like, hey, it works. Why not just keep denying it? Like, clearly sexual assault is not a deal breaker when it should be.
Senator Tom Cotton is a very serious person, and he believes that we should be on guard following this pandemic for the sorts of people who might be coming in to eventually do us harm. Take a look.
It's a scandal to me that we have trained so many of the Chinese Communist Party's brightest minds to go back to China to compete for our jobs, to take our business, and ultimately to steal our property and design weapons and other devices that can be used against the American people. So I think we need to take a very hard look at the visas that we give to Chinese nationals to come to the United States to study, especially at the postgraduate level in advanced scientific and technological fields. You know, if Chinese students want to come here and study Shakespeare and the Federalist Papers, that's what they need to learn from America. They don't need to learn quantum computing and artificial intelligence from America.
Well, they're certainly making sure that anybody in China is learning the culture of China. You make a good point.
Okay, so look, we're going to get to Maria Bartiromo as well, because she adds on an extra layer, a dollop of stupid. But I'll give you first crack. What do you think about Tom Cotton, who says that right now the ones we should be worried about are graduate students in from China?
Yeah, I mean, they are on the front lines, you know, saving our loved ones every single day in and outside of hospitals. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, for sure. Let's keep them out. And they're kind. I mean, I'm so disgusted with the amount of racism that this pandemic has brought on. And yet I'm not surprised, but you know, like there are stages of, like, you know, groups who it's okay to hate on that you're like, okay, basically, I thought we were done with anti-Chinese racism. All racism is bad, but I'm like, oh no, oh, we're still doing the yellow fever thing? Cool. All right.
Yeah, I thought we were past it, actually.
I thought we were past it, you know, after, like, you know, the railroads and stuff, and after, you know, like, and also Japanese internment camps when it comes to Asian Americans. And now we're back at it. And this is, I think, really interesting. I think that, you know, and this is where we need the leadership of someone like Bernie Sanders, is to say that the way forward through this pandemic is not more fear-mongering against a so-called foreign adversary. It's not to, you know, drive a further wedge between ourselves and China. It's actually to come together, to, like, put, you know, actually have, like, team up and work together internationally. I'm not saying that, like, that the Chinese government is the, you know, most good faith actors at all. We know that that's not true, but we also know, as progressives and people on the left, to separate governments from people.
Yeah. Yeah, and from the basically from the beginning of this, we knew that xenophobes were going to get fired up over the fact that the virus seems to have originated in China. What we didn't need was high-profile Republicans, including the president and members of the right-wing media, especially Tucker Carlson, continually egging them on. And so, like, on the Damage Report, we started talking about that relatively early on, and we're mocked by the right, you know, by Tucker Carlson, obviously, but even some people who don't consider themselves in the right, who think that focusing on this sort of thing is always, it's playing identity politics, or it's a dot, or whatever. Yep. It's social justice warrior stuff. It's people co-opting the language of the right. And you know, we predicted that it was designed to distract some right-wingers, to get them to focus a little bit less on the failings of the administration and more on the perceived threat that people from Asia or Asian Americans or people who look like they might be Asian or Asian American, that they're the real threat. And indeed, we've seen rising harassment against these communities, including attacks, including incredibly vicious, violent attacks. And that hasn't gone away. And you're continuing to see it. This is just a slightly more sophisticated version. But imagine if you are a graduate student. Imagine if you're from Asia, or if you're Asian American, you're a graduate student. How would you feel knowing that a senator is saying that we should worry about the fact that you might be effectively a spy, that you're only here to steal our knowledge and then to bring it back and eventually lead to the economic or military downfall of America? Like, you would be right to be worried about harassment and possibly assault, and you would be right to assume that this is probably not the last of that that you've seen.
No, I'm just done. I'm done with it. Like, I mean, this is the other thing is, like, all this leads to, you know, you look into the eyes, the dead snake eyes of someone like Senator Tom Cotton, and you're like, what is your end game, dude? Like, where do you want this to go? Are you trying to stoke a war with China? Is that, well, you're not trade war, like a hot war, you know, is that where we're headed? Do you want, you know, because I'm not sure where you go with those comments other than it's right to demonize Chinese American students or Chinese nationals who've come to the U.S. to study. But like, what's the difference anyway? And also, let's get into a hot war with China. Yeah. Like, and this
which Lou Dobbs was calling for.
Right. I mean, and this is where the whole trade war is headed, is like, and actually, I mean, I don't know what's going on with Trump's trade war, but I do know that, like, initially he was trying to not antagonize China because he wanted to, you know, actually, you know, make more progress on whatever deal that he was signing. And I don't begrudge him for that. I'm like, yeah, even if it's for his self-interest, you should be working with China. But now you see that there are some Republicans, more, you know, the hawks in the Republican Party, that are pushing for something that makes absolutely no sense and is incredibly racist and dangerous.
Yeah. Two more points. One to Maria Bartiromo, who added on that, well, you know, in China, they're teaching them Chinese culture. Shakespeare's not American culture.
Yeah.
He ain't American. Yeah. Just look it up, you know. It's a fact. But anyway, and the response that I would give to Tom Cotton, if he actually cared about this, if this was a genuine worry that he had, it's very similar to the Trump obsessing over how history will judge him. Maybe if you took government seriously and your responsibility as a member of a government seriously, you could both fix this problem and also look good doing it. Like, if you're worried about all of these graduate students having so many Chinese exchange students, maybe fund education in America and more of those spots will be taken by Americans. Maybe don't spend decades demonizing the very idea of a college education and especially an advanced degree. I mean, how much time has the right spent making people believe that there's something fundamentally un-American about pursuing education? And what do you know? Not that many Americans pursue masters or PhDs. Isn't it weird how that works out? Maybe go in a different direction will fill up those graduate programs with Americans, and then you don't want to have to worry about these spies that you're constantly so scared of. For the past 2 months or so, this show has been focusing quite a bit on the effect that the current pandemic has had on the United States. But the rest of the world is suffering as well, some communities far more than others. And joining us now to talk about how this particular emergency is interacting with another, the international refugee emergency that we've been dealing with internationally for some time now, very excited to have back on the show journalist and host of the Course Correction podcast, Nellyfer Hidayat. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John.
Very glad to have you here. We spoke several months ago when your podcast, Course Correction, at that point was relatively new. But that's not the only show that you've been working on recently, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we've all had to adjust to the way that the coronavirus has changed all of our industries. And certainly me being in the media and journalism industry, it's just meant that almost everything is online. So I have developed a new show called Dear World Live that we put out every Tuesday, 10 a.m. Eastern time. And it's a real response to the way that the Doha debates ethos plays out in this modern day where coronavirus impacts and permeates every level of all of our lives. So it's a direct response to the coronavirus pandemic.
And one of the things you've been talking about recently on the show is how it's affecting different refugee populations. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so each week we get together and we decide on a specific subject matter. We've already done one on the world's largest lockdown, which is in India. That was our first show. But the one that really is close to my heart, because I'm an Afghan refugee. So I was born in Kabul. I was a refugee for a little while, and then I settled here in London in the United Kingdom, is the story of what's happening to one of the world's arguably most vulnerable populations, the 25 million people in the world who are stateless, who are refugees. And we had on the show the United Nations High Commissioner, Filippo Grandi, who talked to me about the new Trump immigration ban. I mean, I don't know which one we're on at this point. It could be the 10th or the 12th. There we go. But it was really interesting to hear from him because he made two really interesting points that I don't know I agree with, but I was glad to hear. And I don't know if you've got the clip, but it was really interesting.
So why don't we play a little bit of that and then you can tell us a bit more about it.
So you in fact agree with President Donald Trump and the limitation he's placed?
Well, I don't know. You know, these are very political debates. And he was talking about, I think, he was talking about immigration as a whole, not specifically about refugees. My message to the US, to any country, would be let not the right to asylum, the possibility of refugees of crossing borders and seeking protection, refuge from persecution, from war, let this not become a victim of the coronavirus as well.
Okay, so you said that there were some disagreements you had, so tell us about that.
He completely understood, he said, the ban that President Trump wants to put into place. He said that he understands why a nation would want to restrict this kind of migration, certainly with refugees, and that he hopes that in the end, the refugees don't come worse off. But it's strange to me. It feels a little incongruous putting it in the context of the fact that Mr. Trump has a history of banning different types of migration, certainly when it comes to Muslim migrants. Mm-hmm. And to hear someone in his position talk in such an understanding way about refugees and migration to the US, it just feels like, well, you might put the line here, but where would the right, where would the libertarian, where would the sort of far right put that, draw that line? So it was interesting to me that he agreed with Mr. Trump and then kind of went on to say, but let's hope that something better comes out of this.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. That's the issue when you make accommodations with these extremist governments. First of all, I don't think that Donald Trump is that the pandemic is at all influencing this. It's a continuation of a xenophobic foreign policy that's been in place since before he was president. It was one of the main things that he ran on was a Muslim ban. It's obviously opportunistic that he's trying to ram it through, like a lot of other policies that have nothing to do with the coronavirus that he's been pushing through in recent days. And also, I mean, look, we sort of jokingly said it's like the 12th, you know, anti-immigration move that he's made. That's one of the only things that means that this most recent change isn't as bad as it could have been, is that there's not that much immigration left to restrict at this point.
Here's the danger, John, and I'm so glad you made that point. The thing with this is it provides some cover for those really disgusting, views on migration and refugees and asylum seekers. It gives them something to hold in the faces of liberal and progressives to say, oh, well, if the UN High Commissioner on Refugees says this and the other, well, then we can't be that wrong, can we? So I worry that that's a danger. When you put things in these terms where you say, oh, it's acceptable to an extent, what extent? That's where the danger is.
So I mean, I don't know how much else you talked about with this particular official, but like, what does he believe that these refugees should do? And do we have an idea? Are there states that are still acknowledging that particular crisis and working to help some of these many millions of people, as you pointed out? What's their status right now?
Well, I'll put it this way. We had three other guests in two other locations on the Dear World live show on refugees. One of them was Dr. Jamila, who is based in Europe's largest refugee camp in Lesbos, Greece. And the other were two young aid workers out in Cox's Bazar who were themselves Rohingya refugees who had come into Bangladesh in Asia's largest refugee sort of settlement. And they both were talking about the same things. And it was really strange being in this situation as a journalist where you have a high commissioner, you have someone who has great resources, great power, great responsibility, in contact almost with people who are in need of that help and in the service of those people. What I found really telling was the way that Dr. Jamila and our two friends in Cox's Bazar were talking about very specific needs, right? How do you get clean water into a camp with tens of thousands of people? How can you ensure a 6 feet distance between everyone? Yeah. It's not physically possible. And it was just like this butting of heads, John, between our most idealistic hopes and desires in the form of what High Commissioner Grandi was saying and what the reality on the ground is. There's a vast cavernous difference between the experiences of refugees and what we hope we can give them. And let's be honest, goodwill is not exactly at the forefront of everyone's mind. Every nation on earth, be it the United States, the United Kingdom, or Afghanistan, where I'm from, which is battling its own, you know, ferocious coronavirus pandemic, there's not money to go around. Mm-hmm. Indeed, with Mr. Trump's administration taking away funding to the World Health Organization, you have to wonder, where do refugees come when it comes to the divvying out of resources, money, funds, and generosity?
Well, we have to wonder. I doubt he's doing much wondering around that. And it is convenient that many of the same communities inside of the United States and around the world that are going to be most hurt by this pandemic, the pandemic itself is being used as an excuse to not help those communities. That, you know, yes, internationally, refugees are going to be decimated. Well, we've got a problem, so we can't worry about refugees right now. People who live in urban areas, the environmental pollution is making them more susceptible to coronavirus. So also screw them. We're going to push through new changes to regulation through the EPA during this. And so it's just a doubling down on all of the things that made us so vulnerable to this. No, a little bit more on Cox's Bazar, though. So I am curious, do we know if testing is being done? Do we have any idea of what the extent of coronavirus in that or other refugee camps might be?
None. There is no testing in those areas. The most important, vital kind of resource that both in Cox's Bazar with the Rohingya refugees and in Lesbos with those that have made it to Europe's shore are after is real news. Okay, that is the biggest problem facing people in Cox's Bazar, in Moira refugee camp, that there is, you know, fake news, and especially one about what type of people can get coronavirus, what type of people can spread it, is just rampant. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the biggest problems. When you've got such a high, tense, pressure situation, like a refugee camp, where I visited once in Thessaloniki in Greece, in the journalism that I've done, I've been to ones in Europe, I've been to ones across the world. When you've got that kind of situation where people's entire lives are lived in tents or in tiny proximities, it doesn't take much to cause chaos, to cause a lot of suffering. So I think that's something to be careful of. But I want to talk about something else you mentioned, John. You know, I want to bring a bit of more of the European perspective. Look, there is a lot to be said for the fact that refugees will undoubtedly suffer, and they are at the bottom of a very long list of people that are going to suffer. In fact, one of the episodes that we're working on for Dear World Live right now is all about the disability community and how they are adversely affected, be it, you know, in the United States or in Uganda. There are so many vulnerable communities out there that have been struggling, that have been offering solutions to kind of getting them that human capital engaged, that have been left out. So I guess what I'm really frustrated by and what I'm seeing is that the most vulnerable are going to suffer the most. I mean, even in the United States, it's African Americans, it's people who are in that group that are disproportionately bearing the burden. This time, this pandemic, it calls for one thing, for us to look after the most vulnerable and the weakest in our communities. And whether it's Viktor Orban in Hungary, or whether it's Duterte out in the Philippines, or wherever it might be, these totalitarian, these strong men leaders are absolutely grabbing power where they can and risking the lives of their citizens and the people they're in charge of. So my worry is that actually the power grab that we're seeing in small doses all around the world is going to amount to far more severe consequences for populations everywhere.
Yeah, and as one example of that, I saw earlier today that Hungary is about to remove illegal protections and recognition of transgendered individuals. Obviously over concerns around the coronavirus. It's not just a cynical power grab.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and by the way, so I know you probably will have your hands full traveling around the world reporting on the devastating effect that austerity measures are going to be put into effect as a result of the ongoing economic crisis. That's going to be wonderful. But actually, in relation to that, I apologize if this is a stupid question. So you, over the years, you've done multiple different shows where you've traveled around the world and tried to show people what's going on in these countries. Do we have any idea if, like, U.S. media, European media, those sorts of things, if they are locking down, if they're in quarantine? I mean, the fear is that there's other things that are going on that we might not even see, that our eyes are effectively shut to many of these things right now. Is that a concern that I should have? How do you feel about the possibility that there might be less of this sort of investigative international reporting going on right now due to the pandemic?
It's really funny you should mention that. I was talking to one of the more high-ranking officials at the BBC earlier today, pitching him an idea, essentially. And he works for the BBC World Service, which is the international non-English speaking part of the BBC. And I said, how are you even dealing with these times? Because the BBC is an organization that's built around people being there on the ground. And like you said, a lot of the journalism that I've done, whether it's, you know, Dear World Live or it's the podcast that I make, Course Correction, all of these things are designed to connect us to people that we would never naturally get an opportunity to speak to. And talking to this official at the BBC, I realized that journalism itself, the mediascape itself, is going to have to figure out how to tell the world's most important stories. I can't go to Uganda. I can't go to Afghanistan. I can't go to Vietnam. And yet those views and those lives and those people are going to be just as affected as you and me. And so I think this is the biggest challenge within a generation of journalists and foreign correspondents like myself, to be able to get ourselves and get those stories in whatever way possible. And I don't know how optimistic I am. I mean, One of the things that this official at the BBC said was, look, we have to pivot. We can't be there. We're going to have to figure out how to use social media, how to use digital media to get those stories out there. And I said, what have you got in place to be able to do that? And he said, we simply don't know. We're working on it. So I don't think there are any answers right now. But, you know, I hesitate because in America, I'm not sure you have sort of unbiased media. All media in America seems to be very much leaning in one side or another, whereas in the UK we have this veneer, we have this kind of like aspiration to be as non-biased as possible. Whether we make it or not, we don't know, but there does seem to be a difference in the way these things are covered.
That's true. And you know, especially considering some of the difficulties you're talking about, I appreciate that you and many others are doing your best in a difficult situation to continue to tell those stories and to have people on who can tell that story from their own perspective. So thank you for that. Where can people see both the podcast, but also Dear World Live? Where can they view this?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say this really quickly, that the Course Correction podcast and the show Dear World Live are designed to try and change the way that we discuss these big problems. We try to discuss solutions and not just butt heads against one another. So that's really important. If you're looking for a perspective, if you're looking for a way to talk about the solutions out of this gargantuous mess we're in, then the shows are for you, basically. That's my pitch. That's my top line. You can get the Course Correction podcast on any of the podcast streaming services. And Dear World Live, the brand new show from Doha Debates, comes at you every Tuesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. You can catch it on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter. Just follow us at Doha Debates. That's awesome. The pitch.
Nellifer, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, friends. It's me, Sharon McMahon, host of Here's Where It Gets Interesting, a podcast that tells the stories of America you probably haven't heard. Our goal is to ignite your curiosity about the fascinating people and events left out of the textbooks. I'm often joined by guests who share with us their insights about history, culture, and politics, so tune in and get ready to learn about some of the most brain-tingling moments in American history. You can listen to Here's Where It Gets Interesting wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.